Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I welcome you. A special program today, in part inspired by the final presidential debate in this election cycle. I'll be sharing my own thoughts, and I have some guests that will be sharing theirs. I actually left a concert last night. I wasn't going to watch the debates, and a very talented Irish comedian, but I decided at the intermission, I'd appreciated his humor and his show and the great audience, and so I came back and I watched it. I was appalled by what I saw, so I'm going to address the issue today of why we should believe that we have a moral imperative to back the lesser of two evils. I do not believe that that is what we should do. But I'm going to have two guests on today because I heard so many out-and-out lies last night by both parties that I wanted to address some that I consider serious, some that are provable. We can demonstrate the fallacy in both of their arguments and then hopefully establish a platform going forward where we can put our support behind people who really care about the planet, all people, animals, and bringing peace into our lives. That is not a part of selecting an evil. That is a very positive solution for the future. Is it possible that Jill Stein could win this election? It's not possible. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't support her. And I'll get to that a little later. We're going to have two guests on today. Professor Harvey Wasserman will be on in the second part of our program because, on the one hand, Trump said that he wouldn't necessarily, until he looked at all the circumstances, endorse the election of Hillary and Clinton at the end. He wouldn't accept the results. And, of course, immediately everyone said that was political suicide. Well, what if we can prove that there has been political tampering in elections, this one and previous ones, and it's documented? So we will document the corruption and the process itself, giving you specific examples. And Professor Harvey Wasserman, professor of history at Columbia State College, will be here. He's an award-winning investigative journalist to share his research on this, that elections are rigged. We'll present the evidence. That is not in support of Donald Trump. That is in support of the idea that if you think your vote matters, shouldn't your vote be legal? But also something that bothered me was in the discussion, Hillary Clinton bragged about how much of a difference her and her husband and their foundation's efforts were on behalf of Haiti and Haitians. I did not hear Chris Wallace ask one important question, at least during that part of the debate that I saw the last hour, and certainly not on the issues that matter. And I'll get to the issues that were not discussed that should be the topic of conversation, but were not. I also heard in a previous debate about Hillary Clinton bragging about how she brought democracy to Libya. I'll share specific information on that. And also in the debates, when we listen to what they're advocating, these are both classical neoconservative virtues and values. War and the 1%, 1/100th of 1%, the exploitation of our environment, the exploitation of labor, the exploitation of peoples, the gross exploitation of weaknesses in our system. So any place that the people who are supporting either of these candidates can take advantage of people, they will. And I'll give you evidence of that. So that's our program today. It's a special. We're going to begin, before we go to our guest, on the subject of Libya, because there are two parts of the Libyan and Syrian equation that are essential for us to understand. How many times did you hear them talk about how they would deal with ISIS? In point of fact, neither will deal with ISIS in a way that will actually change the circumstances on the ground. For example, emails released through WikiLeaks have shown specifically and conclusively that Hillary Clinton knew and communicated in secret from the State Department that her allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, were engaged in financing ISIS and other terrorist groups, arming them, and frequently with arms that they purchased through the State Department's approval from U.S. war manufacturers, and those same war manufacturers have given millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation. There's your pay to play. But also, if on the one hand we're concerned about ISIS, how do you stop any conflict? Well, first you try to understand the nature of the conflict. Why is there a conflict? And then what are the tools they're using on their side? Well, they're using arms. And they're using arms made in the United States and Great Britain. So wouldn't it make sense, wouldn't it be just reasonable to stop, have an embargo on all arms sales, period? There's too many arms in the world as it is, especially major ones that can, you know, bring down airplanes, then can devastate whole cities. But on the one hand, the neocon weighs the profit that comes from selling arms, and the other, the consequences, the collateral damage or actual damage. That becomes irrelevant. So what you do is you get spinmeisters out there who will give the arguments of why we have to stop terror by creating more munitions and more arms, giving them to our allies, even though it can be shown that the allies are the ones sponsoring terrorism. The most radical, dangerous subset of the Islamic believer is in the Sunni Wahhabist belief. Now, that is completely removed from all of the other forms of the Islamic belief, in that the Wahhabists are the most rabid and radical, and that is Saudi Arabia. And they tolerate no other religion. There's no other freedom of religion allowed in Saudi Arabia. If you openly try to practice any other religion except Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, you would be arrested, and you'd be considered a heretic, and you would probably be either in prison or beheaded. So why are we choosing to have an ally that is intolerant of the rights of women, gays, other religions, and at the same time was participant in 9/11? We know that now. To what degree, we do not, but we know they were a part of it. And also, we know absolutely, and Hillary Clinton knows, and the WikiLeaks prove that our State Department, our national defense agencies, our Defense Department, Pentagon, all of the 16 major intelligence agencies in the White House all have known for years that the people we're supposedly fighting are being funded, trained, protected, and helped if they get injured in Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Is this a game? Are we supposed to be perceived as functionally illiterate? Well, you would believe that's the case, since none of the mainstream media have called them out on this. None. Not the clowns at CNN or the unfortunate compromised individuals at the New York Times and the Washington Post. So how in the world could you say we're fighting terrorists when we're also supporting the allies of terrorists, and we ourselves have trained terrorists? But ours are supposed to be the good terrorist. Define a good terrorist. Define a moderate death. Define a moderate beheading. Define a moderate rape. Define a moderate abuse of young women in these countries. define it. I'd like to hear your perception of it. Then we have Libya, because everything you're seeing in now started in Libya. Here is what they did not tell you. Here is what Hillary Clinton's not taking credit for, and this is absolutely correct and is verifiable. First off, it was the U.S., not NATO, that actually was behind Libya, because NATO would not move without full participation from the United States. In Libya, a home is considered a natural human right. See if that's the same in Qatar, Jordan, United Arab Emirates. In fact, in Gaddafi's what was called Green Book, it states, quote, "The house is a basic need of both the individual and the family. Therefore, it should not be owned by others." End quote. That means that in the United States, if we compared our right to own a home compared to the right of a person in Libya, Libyans never had their home repossessed. We do. We had 6 million people under George Bush and Obama's, 6 million homes, 24 million people were displaced. So Gaddafi actually had more home rights than we have here. And by the way, Gaddafi published his book in 1975. Education and medical treatment were all free. Under Gaddafi, Libya could boast of one of the best health care services in the Middle East and all of Africa. Also, if a Libyan citizen could not access the desired educational course or correct medical treatment in Libya, they were funded to go abroad. That means all their medical bills, transportation, living expenses were paid for by the government, never having to be paid back. Now, in the United States, every day, millions of Americans cannot afford basic medical help. You have to be covered under specific conditions, you have co-pays, you have deductibles, and millions of people are still not covered. When was the last time a person who needed help in the United States, where it was not provided, the United States government would fly them to France or another country for treatment? How about never? Gaddafi carried out the world's largest irrigation project. There's never been a project before or since that matched it. The largest irrigation system in the world, also known as the Great Man-Made River, was designed to make water readily available to all Libyans across the entire country. And it worked. It dwarfed any of the man-made environmental projects, including the Hoover Dam in the United States. In Libya, you were allowed to start your own farming business. Let's say you wanted to do a farm. The Libyan government would buy you a farm, buy you livestock, buy you seed, all free of charge. You would be completely set up to do business. You would own it yourself, not the government, and you wouldn't pay a penny out of pocket. A bursary was given to mothers with newborn babies. Every woman who gave birth in Libya was given $5,000 for herself and her child. All electricity was free. Absolutely no electrical bills. Water was free. And petrol was very inexpensive. In fact, when Libya was under Gaddafi, the average cost of a liter of gasoline was 14 cents. Gaddafi raised the level of education to the highest in Africa for the average Libyan. Before Gaddafi, only 25% of Libyans were literate, even a grade school education. But later, it was 87%. In fact, 25% of all Libyans that went to school earned university degrees. It was free. Libya had its own state bank, which provided loans at zero interest and no repossessions. By law, they had no external debt. None. Libya was a debt-free nation. And then the most interesting thing was the gold denier. Before the fall of Tripoli and his untimely demise, which Hillary Clinton cackled at, Gaddafi was trying to introduce a single African currency linked to gold, and following in the footsteps of the late great pioneer Marcus Garvey, who first coined the term United States of Africa, Gaddafi wanted to introduce and only trade in the African gold denier, a move which would have thrown the world economy in chaos. The denier was widely opposed by all the elites, the oligarchy of today's society, who could be affected. African nations would have finally had the power to bring itself out of debt, no longer relying upon the International Monetary Fund and structural adjustments and poverty, and only trade in this precious commodity. This would have been able to finally say no to external exploitation and change forever the use of their own resources. They, the African nations, would have had the priority of their own precious resources. So it has been said that the gold denier was the real reason for NATO and U.S.-led fighting. And what we have to do is look at what Gaddafi did and then look at where the average Libyan is today. In chaos, over 25,000 to 40,000 murdered citizens, and the country is now a hotbed for terrorist activity, including ISIS, al-Nusra. They're all there, al-Qaeda. So exactly what is it that Hillary Clinton is taking credit for? I'd like to know. What part of this democracy is something we should value? I'm Gary Nall. Let us now go to our conference call, and we're going to Dallas, Texas. We're standing by is Dr. Didi Cherry. She's a Haitian-born journalist, an associate professor in biological sciences, who's been at the forefront publicly about the challenges Haiti confronts and the corruption of American interest. She was the first person to cite the likely introduction of cholera into Haiti by the UN personnel in 2010, which the UN denied and would not help with. Now they acknowledge it, but for all these years, they did not. And as a result, tens of thousands have died. She also reported on Haiti's considerable mineral wealth as a lucrative target for Western corporate interest and exploitation. And also, Daddy is the co-editor-in-chief of the News Junkie Post with geopolitical commentator Gilbert Mercer, and is the editor of the news site that carries her articles and appears on Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, Global Research. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleased to be here. Thank you, Gary.
When I think of Haiti and the Clintons bragging about how much they've done for Haitians and why 90% of all the money they make through the Clinton Foundation they give out to other charities, which is patently false, and that there's no pay to play, I just want to go back and let people know that Papa Doc Duvalier was an absolute genocidalist. The man was a sociopath. His son was no better, and yet America backed both of them, actually provided transportation to get them safely out of the country and to loot the entire treasury of all of its money and take it to an equally corrupt country, France, that seems to give safe haven to all the former dictators who have been caught stealing, as does Switzerland and the corrupt banking system there. And I'm wondering why no one ever did an article on the fact that how can you be such a killer, destroying people, killing people, murdering people, stealing the people's money, and then a country allows you to come in because you're willing to spend it and spread it around, but you don't see the moral equation there, and that's what happened with France. Anyhow, the Duvalier dictatorship was ousted in a bloody coup in 1986, and since 2010, in what I consider, my personal belief, completely fraudulent sham elections, Haiti has been ruled by one of Barack Obama's supported dictators, Michel Martelly. And in January 2015, Martelly started to rule by armed decree as Haitians rose up against him in protest. So what did the U.S. do? The U.S., through Ambassador Samantha Powers, strengthened Martelly's commitment to the U.S. interest. So now what we have is we have, why does the U.S. and its corporate sponsors have such a deep interest in Haiti? And what resources does Haiti have that the West wants so badly to exploit?
Yeah, it is unfortunate that Haiti is so close to the United States. That is part of the problem. In addition, contrary to what Clinton said about Haiti being the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, which is, and I should warn everybody that whenever anybody says that, my experience is that they're getting ready to rip off Haiti. Okay. Haiti actually has a wealth of gold. It has offshore oil. None of this is actually particularly fortunate because when this stuff gets extracted, it will probably be done in the worst possible way. But this is part of the reasons why the Clintons have their claws into Haiti. But another part, another major part, is they want to turn all of Haitian labor toward export. And they want Haiti to import for all its needs from the United States. So Haiti is going to become almost like to the United States, the ideal Haiti would be almost like a penal colony where you get to control everything that goes in and everything that goes out. This is basically what the Clintons have set out to do in Haiti. They presumably discovered Haiti during a pleasure trip, which really I think about and I hope had never happened. And then they managed to get their hooks in Haiti around 1994 or so, after Aristide was removed from office, and then Clinton brought Aristide back to Haiti. And this got him a lot of support from Haitian Americans in the United States when he was running for re-election later on. But what he did, actually, when he brought Aristide back to Haiti, it was under many, many conditions with many, many strings. And one of these was that the U.S. would be allowed to dump Arkansas rice in Haiti. This completely devastated the rice cultivation, the small rice farmers in Haiti. The U.S. was just dumping subsidized Arkansas rice as a way to destroy the Haitian agricultural economy. Haiti was an agricultural country. Now, I'll tell you, based on what the Clintons have done to Haiti, here's where we are now. In 2014 to 15 alone, agricultural imports in Haiti went up 30% in 1 year, 30%. Agricultural exports are virtually nil. The whole country had $29 million in agricultural exports, okay, which was just four products, cocoa, coffee, mango, and lobster. That's it. And in that 1 year, Haiti acquired a deficit, a $900 million deficit, because it had to import so much agricultural goods. So this is where we are. Haitian agriculture is destroyed. This is now being blamed on Hurricane Matthew, which is absolute nonsense. Hurricane Matthew did not destroy Haitian agriculture. Clinton did. Bill and Hillary Clinton have done more damage to Haiti than any number of natural disasters could do, including the earthquake and the recent hurricane. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that they actually ran Haiti for 18 months. Right after the earthquake, people were still on their backs. Clinton moved in. He forced the country to declare a state of emergency that would allow him to run all the reconstruction along with a group of wealthy donors. And he managed to form this organization that is called the IHRC, Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, I call it I, Hillary Rodham Clinton, okay, he formed this organization that functioned as an umbrella for all of the aid that was coming into Haiti. And he and Hillary Clinton just went all over the world begging for aid for Haiti. So under this organization, you had Inter-American Development Bank, you had the UN, you had the World Bank, you had private donors, you had charities, everything, absolutely every dollar that was coming into the country as aid came under the control of the Clintons. And they had 18 months to actually do something with this money. They managed to collect $9.5 billion over 2 years. Okay. And out of that, they spent about 3%. And the 3%, their major achievement was actually a sweatshop complex that was not even in the area that was earthquake damage. It was put in northern Haiti. And it was basically the major clients are actually South Korean, and it's a place where Haitian women work for 40 cents an hour. All right, so they've accounted for only 3% of the $9.5 billion that they collected for Haiti. They never rebuilt anything. After 18 months of this organization, people started demanding to know what they were achieving, and they couldn't show it. And the Haitian government, what was left of it, that didn't dissolve itself, declared Clinton's outfit to be a complete fraud, and it did not renew it. And in fact, afterwards, a couple of lawyers took him to court. Brought the case to Haiti's Superior Court of Auditors and Administrative Disputes. And the court actually demanded that Bill Clinton account for the IHRC money. And he basically said that, well, I am UN Special Envoy, and as UN Special Envoy to Haiti, I have immunity, and therefore I don't have to account to the court for the IHRC money. Now, what I have proposed in several articles is that some of this money may have found its way into Hillary Clinton's campaign. And I would like them to prove me wrong if that is true. Because this is the biggest chunk of money they have ever collected. We hear a lot about the Clinton Foundation. Now, the Clinton Foundation existed before the IHRC. And it started out in 1997. It was supposed to be a library, and then it grew into all sorts of things it was not supposed to be. And as we know from the WikiLeaks and from a lot of work that's been done by various people, that this was a way for people to donate money to the Clintons so that they could get favorable decisions, from her as Secretary of State and so on. Now, when the earthquake happened in Haiti, the Clinton Foundation raised about $30 million for Haiti. Now, that money sort of melted into this kind of IHRC thing. So that came under the charity donations to the IHRC. Now the Clinton Foundation, if you look at its taxes, it gives about 10% of the money it collects to actually charitable grants. 90% is spent on itself. And so when Hillary Clinton said, oh, you know, they've got this great record and so on, and you know, this was just a lie. This was a lie. So the $30 million that they supposedly collected for Haiti through the Clinton Foundation, probably only about $3 million found itself into charitable grants, and it's not clear what that is. So $9.5 billion that came to Haiti through the IHRC, including the $3 million from the Clinton Foundation. 97% of that, we do not know what happened to it. Port-au-Prince, which and Laogan, which are the main cities that were affected by the earthquake, were not reconstructed. Okay, and so and therefore, with Hurricane Matthew, there has been yet more damage, yet more deaths that are due to the Clintons. And I should say that when the earthquake happened and the Clintons were already at work on Haiti, what they were doing was driving the poor farmers out of the rural areas into the area of Port-au-Prince so that they could work in sweatshops. They call them free trade zones. That's a polite name for them, free trade zones. But basically, so that these poor people could come and they would work in sweatshops for, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents an hour. Okay? So you had huge population pour into Haiti. Haiti had, Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, had 750,000 people in 1994. When the earthquake happened in 2010, it had 3 million people. And I attribute two-thirds of the death in the earthquake to policies that the Clintons were directly responsible for, because they are the ones who actually herded all these poor rural people into Port-au-Prince to work for their sweatshops. And the damage that they have done is just... It's hard for anybody to imagine. And as somebody who loves Haiti, who grew up in Haiti, and who is also American, this is a double nightmare to see my country of birth gets destroyed by these people who are now coming to the United States to basically apply everything that they have used in Haiti so that they can destroy the United States too.
Final question for you. President Aristide was removed in June of 2004 through a U.S.-sponsored coup. Aristide's party, the Famille Lavalas, was banned from the 2010 election so Martelly could win. Tell us about the Clintons and her as Secretary of State threatening Haitian officials opposing Martelly with loss of visas if they did not support his second term elections. And Martelly won regardless of not having the votes. There's a clear case of voter fraud. Give us the background on that.
Oh, absolutely. In 2004, they removed Aristide. And, of course, in the 2010 elections, the Lavalas party was not allowed to participate, even though it was the most popular party. Now, you had a whole series of candidates, and the candidates that came out on top in November 2010 were Milan Maniga and Jude Celestin. And Michel Martelly did not make it to the top two for the first round. Hillary Clinton made a special trip to Haiti in January 2011 to demand that the election should be recounted in such a way that Martelly would make it to the top two candidates. So basically, it was the Organization of American States that was charged with verifying this, and basically they decided, okay, well, we're gonna say that no precinct should have more than a certain number of votes, and that should do it. They got rid of this guy Jude Celestin and put Michel Martelly instead. And sure enough, when they did the second round, Michel Martelly came on top. Yes, and she did threaten. She went around and she threw her weight around, and she threatened to revoke people's visas. And I should say, this is something that's quite serious, because some people are actually sick who are getting treatment in the United States, for them, it's a death sentence. And so this kind of thing where she just marches into Haiti and threatens to revoke people's visas is not trivial, you see.
But the mainstream, I'm just trying to show that from the American support of Papa Doc to the exploitation of its labor force and its natural resources, to Bill Clinton coming in and not just with you, he did it with Jamaica also, where he brings in American rice.
Actually, the U.S. did not support Papa Doc. It supported Jean-Claude Duvalier. And there's an important distinction here. François Duvalier was completely paranoid. He was ruthless. He had no tolerance for right or left, but he was definitely nobody's boy. The U.S. Did not support him. When the U.S. got a foothold was in 1971, when he died and Jean-Claude Duvalier became president. Then USAID moved in and basically started running the show. And the U.S. completely supported Jean-Claude Duvalier, and that's when the country completely opened up to manufacturing baseballs and being an assembly workshop for the United States. Yes, and there was complete misery, absolute misery. People were selling their organs, selling their blood, and so on to survive. Yeah, this is what the United States was supporting.
Also, the United States under Obama supported military occupation of Haiti. Most Americans are not aware of that.
Yes, in 2004, after they removed Aristide, they brought in a military occupation. This military occupation was done through the United Nations, but it is in every way a military occupation. Is completely illegal. The United Nations had no business occupying a country that was not at war, where there wasn't any kind of strife going on. This was a deal that Clinton made with the United Nations, and probably with Ban Ki-moon, who became Secretary General of the United Nations in 2007.
So
when Hillary Clinton was running for president for the first time.
Dottie, we only have a minute to go, but when you're watching an election debate and you see Hillary Clinton bragging about her husband, and the foundation's enormous support and help and all the projects in Haiti, and you know the truth on the ground, and you know that it's worse now than ever, you know that the entire country of one point of Haiti was able to produce enough food that fed their own citizens and was able to actually export for a period of time. But then when Clinton came in, he brought in so much cheap rice that the average Haitian farmer, as was also true in Jamaica, because I went down to Jamaica and spent time in the country speaking with people, and they told me, we have to buy, see these potatoes? These are American potatoes, because if we grow our own potatoes, it costs us more to grow them when these American potatoes come in under Bill Clinton. So this destroyed their economy, and no one in the media is holding the Clintons accountable for what they've done, not just to Haiti, but throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean. Now, on top of that, exploiting the earthquake for $9 billion. Some say it's as high as $12 billion. But in any case, using the IHRC as a way of taking over Haiti for all intents and purposes, they ruled Haiti for 18 months, and with occupation forces there to back them up. And the Haitians today, if you go to Haiti, you will not see any of the money that was collected for them from this group. You won't see it building new houses. And the Red Cross got $500 million, built six houses, another corrupt organization. So it must really discourage you that the American media was not jumping in there, including the left, including the so-called corporate liberal media, challenging her.
Yes. Yes, the American media is a complete disgrace. They are the best, I think, reason for not voting for Hillary Clinton, because if she can control the media to this extent, imagine what would happen in a Clinton in a Clinton presidency. I think that as far as the lesser of two evil, we have reached the end of the line. As I have said before on the record, I would vote for the devil before I would vote for Hillary Clinton.
Well, we don't have a devil, but we have a very good person in Jill Stein, and we can begin to rebuild a coalition of progressive and compassionate and sensible minds, not for now, but for the future. And if we have done that when Ralph Nader was running, today we wouldn't have a Clinton and Trump debate. We would have reasonable multiple parties involved. But that's what happened when the egotists, the elitists, the narcissists within the left thought they were smart, and they weren't. They're one step above imbecilic when it comes to understanding human nature outside of their own political and ideological mindset. They are absolutely in contempt of anything that is reasonable and responsible. And I hold them responsible for this whole mess because they could have backed multiple parties. They could 41% of the public are independent. They could have backed Jill Stein, and they didn't. So shame on them. So I thank you very much for being with us today. Dottie Sherry, S-H-E-R-Y, Haitian-born journalist.
C-H-E-R-Y.
I'm sorry, yes. And I thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, come back with Professor Harvey Wasserman to talk about, is it possible that Trump was right on this issue, if nothing else, when he said the election is rigged? Have we been rigging elections? He'll tell us about it. I'd like to welcome you all. I'm Gary Nall. What was not on the discussion last night or in the previous ones? The justification of $5 trillion that is an accepted amount, plus all the broken lives, dead bodies, suicides, the millions of people adversely affected and are now in their own country, they're refugees or have fled to other countries. Over 45 million people have been adversely affected based upon our interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and that does not include Libya and Syria, or now we're actually bombing and fighting from warships inside of Yemen on the side of our completely tyrannical, completely corrupt, completely maniacal and evil Saudi Arabia. Not a word about that $5 trillion. Do you realize what $5 trillion spent on public health projects, spent on a reforestation, spent on rebuilding our entire infrastructure, rebuilding all of our inner cities, providing quality free education and health care, single payer? We could have done all that with that $5 trillion. Instead, this went into the pockets of the people who are backing Hillary Clinton. And if nothing else, what does it tell you when people like Donald Rumsfeld voting for Hillary, George Bush Sr. voting for Hillary? In fact, the Koch brothers and the Fortune 500 people all voting for Hillary because they know nothing will change and they'll continue to be able to exploit everything for their benefit, and the police state will continue. Also not discussed was the military-industrial complex and its corruption. It not discussed was the spying on Americans and our loss of our liberties and the National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act, and other ways that they have chosen to make anything we, the citizens, do in our interest, protest, into a domestic terrorist crime. The militarization of police was not discussed. The starvation in our own country, people over 3 million Americans living on less than $2 a day. This is not Africa. This is not the Sudan. This is not Ethiopia. This is in America. 2 to 3 million Americans living on $2 or less per day. 18 million hungry children who are food insecure per day. 1.6 million American children leaving school each day and having no place to go home to. They're homeless per day. and over 100 million Americans at the abject poverty level, nearly one-third of our entire population, nor 106 million gainfully one-time employed people capable of working have no work today. And the fallacy of a 5% unemployment rate when the real unemployment rate in America is between 28 to 40%, depending upon which group you're referring to. So we've just been lied to at every level. So we didn't have anything on climate change and nothing on campaign finance, getting all money out of elections. None of that was discussed, and that's unfortunate. But one thing was discussed, but then was mocked and ridiculed by all the mainstream media, was that this election was in any way rigged. Now we have Professor Harvey Wasserman, professor of history at Columbia State College. He is an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and a national voice in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements for over 40 years. He was also a senior advisor for Greenpeace and the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and founder of solartopia.org, which is a grassroots endeavor to promote green-powered Earth. His book is Strip and Flip, Selection of 2016, and Five Jim Crows and Electronic Election Theft. His website is solartopia.org. Nice to have you with us today, Harvey.
Gary, it's always great to be with you. It's a great show.
Thank you. Harvey, I'd like for you to start now and go backwards to, let's just go back to Al Gore when he was running against George Bush. How many of these elections can you prove with hard, qualified evidence, prima facie evidence, were rigged in any way by either party, and how were they done, and were there any consequences to the people who engaged in this rigging?
Well, Gary, the 2000 and 2004 elections were definitely stolen. Al Gore, not that he deserved it, but Al Gore was the rightful winner in 2000, and John Kerry was the rightful winner in 2004. The election in 2000 was stolen in Florida, basically by George W. Bush's brother, Jeb, who was the governor at the time, and who stripped more than 90,000 of legitimate registered citizens from the voter rolls, all of them, or virtually all of them, black and Hispanic, in an election that was decided by 537 votes. The same thing was done in Ohio 2004, although there were more things done in Ohio 2004. They also flipped the electronic vote count, but more than 300,000, mostly black and Hispanic voters, were stripped from the voter rolls in Ohio 2004 in an election that was decided by 118,775. So this is 100% provable. My co-author Bob Fitrakis and I have lived in central Ohio through these elections, and we saw it firsthand in 2004. Now, Donald Trump is complaining about a rigged election this year, and he could be right, except that he's talking about exactly the wrong thing. He is complaining that millions of black and Hispanic citizens or non-citizens will vote multiple times and therefore give the election to Hillary. This just isn't going to happen. People do not vote multiple times. It's a five-year felony. It's very hard to do, and it makes no sense to do when you have electronics that can flip an election with a few keystrokes in less than 10 seconds. What Donald wants done, which is the stripping of black and Hispanic voters from the voter rolls, is being done. The Republican Party, in at least two dozen states, is using a computer program, which has been documented by Greg Palast, and it's in his movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, to remove literally millions of black and Hispanic voters from the voter rolls. What Trump now is talking about doing is pure fascism. He wants to have so-called monitors from his campaign going to the polling places to so-called check to see if what people are legitimate voters, but obviously what they're going to do is try to intimidate black and Hispanic voters who show up. And so he's right that the election can be rigged, but he's exactly wrong in what he's saying about how it can be rigged.
Okay, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, important from my perspective is that we now, through WikiLeaks, have absolute proof from their own internal emails at the Democratic National Committee, who is supposed to stay neutral, that they were working, conspiring, to get Hillary nominated over Bernie Sanders. We saw the support and groundswell for Bernie Sanders, and there were repeated challenges in California, Colorado, Washington State, New York, and other places that he actually had more votes. So was there? What can we say about that part of this being rigged on by the Democratic National Committee to get Hillary into a position rather than Bernie Sanders? That part.
Well, there's no doubt in our minds that Bernie Sanders was the rightful Democratic nominee. We have about a dozen states where there's significant differences between the exit polls and the actual outcome. And there's no doubt that Debbie Schultz and the rest of the Democratic Party apparatus conspired to prevent Bernie from getting the nomination for obvious political reasons. Bernie is significantly to the left of Hillary and ran an anti-corporate campaign, and Hillary is basically a product of the corporate war machine. And this is part of a longstanding American tradition. It's certainly been in place in terms of electronic voting machines since 1988. The first instance that we have of an American election being flipped electronically was the 1988 New Hampshire primary, when George H.W. Bush won, former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, defeated Bob Dole in a primary where Dole was leading by 8% prior to the vote and lost by 8% after the vote. It's a virtual statistical impossibility, and it was done by electronic means that Bush had perfected while he was the head of the CIA in other countries around the world. We've been overthrowing governments and rigging elections for a very long time, certainly since World War II. So, and this technology has then been applied within our own elections, especially by the Republican Party. But, one of the reasons the Democrats don't want to raise this issue is they use these flipping techniques themselves, as you mentioned, in the Bernie Sanders to defeat Bernie Sanders in this year's primaries. Also, we are very dubious about the alleged victory of Rahm Emanuel for mayor in Chicago. And so this is really a two-party conspiracy where the major corporate parties retain for themselves the ability to basically shape an outcome however they want. The primary means now, Gary, is electronic. About 80% of our votes in this country are cast either on electronic voting machines or using Scantron ballots, which are counted on rigged computers. And the courts have ruled that the source code on these electronic apparatuses for counting our votes is proprietary. So we are, and the machines are privately owned in general, and even when they're leased or owned by the election boards, the software is still beyond their reach. And so we are conducting public elections on private machines owned by private corporations that do not allow a public recount or public monitoring. It's absurd. It's complete nonsense. And so the actual electronic outcomes of most of the elections in the United States are virtually meaningless. If you have a governor and a secretary of state from the same party conducting an election on the state level, and our elections are basically run by the states, at come election night, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, they can make the outcome whatever they want. And we have no way of monitoring or having any accountability on the outcome.
When is there any truth that George Soros has a financial interest in recently in voting machine companies?
It's Warren Buffett.
Buffett
has owns ES&S or has an interest in ES&S, which has become the number one voting machine company in the country. And this is a conspiracy theory that is 100% true. I was a plaintiff in a federal lawsuit in 2004 in Ohio. They denied me my absentee ballot. I was part of the King Lincoln Bronzeville lawsuit. Bob Fitrakis, my co-author, was the attorney. We won a federal decision in the federal courts requiring the 88 counties of Ohio to produce all their records from the 2004 election so we could have a meaningful recount. And when it came time for these counties to deliver, 56 of the 88 counties in Ohio said their election materials had been destroyed or lost. In one county, they said a coffee urn spilled on all the ballots. In another county, they said the ballots had been mistakenly put out with the recycling. And so there was never a meaningful recount in the 2004 election in Ohio, which gave George W. Bush a second term. Very similar stuff happened in Florida 2000. And I have to say, Gary, in 2014, there are three U.S. Senate elections that we are pretty sure were flipped in Alaska, Colorado, and North Carolina. And one of the reasons that the Republicans have the majority in the U.S. Senate that they do is because these three elections were flipped. But this is the kind of flipping that Donald Trump would support. What he's talking about here is the opposite is happening. He's you know, ranting that blacks and Hispanics are going to come pouring across the borders and out of the ghettos, and they're going to vote, you know, six or seven times, and they're going to give Hillary the election. In fact, the opposite is happening. There has been millions of black and Hispanic American citizens consciously disenfranchised in at least two dozen states in this country through the use of various computerization techniques, and we've seen it in Ohio. Over a million voters out of 5.5 million in Ohio have been disenfranchised by the Republican Secretary of State. And, you know, this may not affect the election for president. Hillary may yet win, but you look at the down ballot situation, you look at the House and the Senate, and, you know, the mayors and the Congress, state legislatures, and the state legislatures really, Gary, in recent years have been the big prize. The Republicans have taken over the state legislatures, and they've done it basically by what we call stripping and flipping. They strip the voter rolls of mostly black, Hispanic, young, poor, elderly voters who might go the other way, and then they flip it when they don't. When that's not sufficient, they just flip it electronically. And this is a ridiculous situation in a country that calls itself a democracy.
Harvey, what you're saying is, yes, we do have vote rigging in the United States done by both parties at the state and the federal level. And with the system that we have, it's almost going to ensure that one party or another, depending upon what they have the resources to do, could create an outcome that they want. And this just makes a mockery of our democracy.
Absolutely. You can't call it a democracy. It's not even close. I mean, we wrote the strip and flip selection of 2016, and we're updated after the election. I've got a piece coming out at reader-supported news in a few minutes, and we'll have it at PRN, Gary, that talks about this. And there is a long tradition of doing this in U.S. history, dating right to the Constitution, where the Electoral College was set up to allow slave owners to vote, count votes for three-fifths of their slaves who couldn't vote. And then after the Civil War, the Jim Crow laws came in, and the Ku Klux Klan came in to intimidate black voters in the South. And then Richard Nixon set up the drug war to disenfranchise. You know, there were 41 million arrests in the drug war since 1971, and this has been their method of preventing blacks and Hispanics from voting.
But keep in mind who caused the three strikes you're out, who caused more people of color to be incarcerated than any other president in American history. That was Bill Clinton.
Yes, absolutely.
And who said in one of her emails, and also one of her speeches, that she will never approve the legalization of marijuana ever, and yet she calls herself, you know, of the people and progressive. She is not. I think,
right.
and we know that Donald Trump, at one level, of course he's going to lose, but watching him is like watching a 14-year-old who wants to be a samurai and is entitled because he comes from a wealthy background, and his father gave him a sword. He takes the sword out of the sheath and immediately cuts both of his ears, his scalp off. That's probably why someone cut him that dead cat and put it on his head.
Well, he's a classic fascist, Donald Trump. He's a Mussolini. He's not Hitler. He's not going to open death camps, but he is a Mussolini or a Berlusconi. He's a rich guy who just doesn't believe in democracy and will start beating people up. Mussolini was famous for beating up legislators who didn't agree with him. And, you know, he's a street thug with a lot of money. And he's right, but he advocates the kind of election rigging that he's yelling about.
Harvey, we're out of time. We got to go, but
okay,
I thank you for being on. And you can hear Harvey Professor Harvey Wasserman, one of the greatest advocates out there for denuclearizing America, closing down the plants. He and Carl Grossman have caused the closing of about four plants. So we appreciate all of his great efforts. His program is called Green Power and Wellness Hour every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Progressive Radio Network. His website is solartopia.org. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. A special today, just watching that sordid, perverse, disgusting debate. I had no choice but to do this hour. We'll be back to our regular program tomorrow. Have a nice day.